Today's Teisho will be on Case 15, Wu Mong's No Preaching on Oneness. Angho's Introduction. The death-dealing blade, the life-giving sword, they were the custom in ancient days and are still today the touchstone. Tell me, what is the death-dealing blade? What is the life-giving sword? See the following. Main subject, a monk asked Wu Mong, what is it when no thought is stirring and nothing presents itself? Wu Mong said, no preaching on oneness. Secho's verse, no oneness, each holds one tally. He lives and dies with you all the same. The 84,000 did not respond quickly. The 33 entered the tiger's cave. Remarkable, see how turbulent the moon reflected on the waves. So this koan is actually part of a pair, like a matching pair. The other one is case 15, Wu Mong's no preaching on oneness. And case 14 is Wu Mong's preaching on oneness. And the case 14 goes like this. I won't read the whole thing, but I'll read the main subject. A monk asked Wu Mong, what is the teaching of the Buddha's lifetime? Wu Mong said, preaching facing oneness. So this is the same teacher, Wu Mong, Master Cloud Gate, Yun Men. And we have two different teishos, two different koans, side by side. Case 14, Wu Mong's preaching oneness. And case 15, Wu Mong's no preaching on oneness. So not only are each one of them a koan, but in relation to one another, they're also a koan. They're also a big contradiction. So, you know, one of the secret teachings of all koans is that life is inherently contradictory. So, you know, whatever the koan might be, it involves a contradiction. And so both of these koans together form a contradiction. The Buddha's teaching of the Buddha's lifetime is preaching oneness. And also, Wu Mong recommends no preaching on oneness. You know, does a dog have Buddha nature? Mo. So, you know, a dog is supposed to have Buddha nature. According to Buddhist teachings, all beings possess Buddha nature. All sentient beings possess Buddha nature. So when Joshu is asked, does a dog possess Buddha nature? He says, mo. Instead of yes, dogs are sentient beings and therefore dogs have Buddha nature, he says mu. The koan I often talk about, if you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. You know, I can go through the Mu Wong Kan, and it's like koan after koan involves us in a contradiction. So case 38, a buffalo passes through the window. Gosho said, a buffalo passes through the window. Head, horns, and four legs all go through. Why can't the tail go through? See, contradiction. When you meet a man of the way, do not greet him with words or with silence. How will you meet him? Contradiction. So all of these koans have at their heart a contradiction. And this might seem strange, actually, when you think about Buddhism. Because, you know, one of the teachings of Buddhism, one of the fundamental teachings is oneness, right? Oneness of all things. So, you know, when you read Buddhist literature, especially stories about Zen masters, you know, there's always the empty circle, the enso, and this represents the oneness of all things. And uh, And oneness is a basic aspect of all Buddhist teaching, as opposed to duality, which is like two-ness. So this is a path that is concerned with recognizing the fundamental unity of all things. And yet, in the Zen path, there's this constant encounter with contradiction. And the message here is that in a certain way, contradiction is inescapable. They're actually inescapable because what we call life is made up of contradictions. I've noticed many contradictions in my life. So, for example, when I was a teenager, I had a lot of conflicts with my parents, especially my mother. And I remember sometimes having arguments with her that were so heated and prolonged that I would lock myself in the bathroom and just scream. When I look back on it, I feel so sorry for my mother. But, we had this personality clash for a long time. And it just seemed like if I said the sky was blue, it was something, it was not blue. If I said right, she said left. It seemed like I could never do anything to please her. And yet, in retrospect, I realized that, it sounds terrible to say, but I realized that I loved my mother more than any other, really, more than anybody else in my family. I really loved her, And after she passed away, it just hit me like a ton of bricks that this person I had argued with, who I didn't agree with about anything, really meant the most to me, maybe of any human being in my life. Don't tell my wife, but I realized that, and my sister-in-law and my wife have a classic history of sibling rivalry. My wife's older sister and my wife, her older sister's name is Sydney, and my wife's name is Barbara. Sydney and Barbara had this sibling rivalry going on throughout their whole teenage years and into college. I remember once when I had come back, Barbara and I had come back from hiking in the Pecos wilderness when we were both in college. I remember my wife and her sister actually starting to like wrestle. You usually don't see women wrestle, but they actually, it wasn't playful. It was like they were actually like struggling. And so it was like a physical conflict. They didn't hit each other, but it was close to that, And it was joking in a way, but there was a lot of tension. So, my sister-in-law, Sydney, had to go in for open heart surgery. She's 76 and she's okay. She has a failing heart valve in the middle of her heart. So they had to open her chest up, open her heart up. It was like a 5.5-hour operation. It's like, wow. And Barbara told me that Sydney has like a scar going down. It's like no more bathing suits at the beach. She has a scar going from like her shoulder all the way down to her navel. But my wife, when she was talking about her sister, had this revelation. She turned to me and she said, "Kurt, Sydney is the heart of our family." She said, "Sydney is the heart of our," and she, for my wife, that was so unusual. She's usually not highly demonstrative like that. But I don't think she had realized that Sydney was like the life of her family, the heart of her family. So, she and Sydney had this conflicted relationship, for like 50 years. And in fact, Sydney came to visit us about 8 years ago, and she and my wife had like a big argument, and Sydney jumped in the car and drove back to New Mexico. It was like so heated. But, you know, that contradiction somehow is inseparable from, you know, their love for each other. You know, it's like, I think that sometimes contradiction is how we make contact with the other person. It's like we rub up against that person, we come up against that person, and it triggers all kinds of reactions in ourselves, some of which are not easy to deal with. Lots of emotions like jealousy, envy, many different things, right? And that can produce this tension. But, you know, sometimes as a result of that tension, you really deeply come into contact with the other person. And you come into contact more deeply with yourself. You know, so we kind of think of contradiction as something you should avoid, right? But that may be a mistake. That may be a mistake. You know, contradiction may be the way we get in contact with the world more fully. You know, as we go through our lives, we get very good at creating a kind of cocoon around ourselves, right? We learn how to be in our own bodies and in our own lives. And we get good at screening out the things that we don't want to deal with, right? It makes sense, right? I mean, so, you know, some people like to get up in the morning and listen to the radio. I'm one of these people. I get up and I sit and meditate, and then I go in and I turn on the news. So I have this wonderful, peaceful experience of meditation for an hour and a half. And then I turn on the BBC and it'll be talking about, you know, some war somewhere. And my wife gets up later than I do, and she'll come downstairs and it's like, oh my God, why are you listening to that? You know, and it seems like such a contradiction, right? I have been in this peaceful place, and then I turn on this terrible news. The news of the world is usually pretty distressing. But you know, for some reason, after I sit, I can deal with it. You know, I can deal with it. And it's not just that. It's like if I don't turn on the radio and hear the bad news, I know less about my world. And I know less about my world. You know, so it's possible to create, we say, live in a bubble. You know, it's possible to live in a bubble where, you know, you've made your world so completely that you're not, you know, confronted or challenged by things. And this, I think this happens to older people. You know, as an older person, you know, I have a friend who is a retired librarian. And he pretty much lives in his world. He has a house down the street. He goes shopping to the places he likes. He's a wonderful man. And he reads all the time, and he exposes me to all these interesting novels. But, you know, like so many people, he's built his world pretty much according to his tastes and expectations. And, you know, I'm happy for him. But, you know, maybe he needs more disruption in his life. Maybe he needs a little bit more contradiction in his life. You know, it's definitely the case that when we encounter contradiction, it rocks us back on our heels, and it makes us uncomfortable. But it's actually both a way of, like, knowing the world more fully and knowing ourselves more fully. You know, contradiction is really like essential because we do create like this cocoon around ourselves. And, you know, sometimes people have the, you know, proverbial rude awakening, right? You know, you've been so good at creating a life for yourself and screening out what makes you uncomfortable that something can happen and it throws you into complete disorder, complete chaos, because now you realize, you know, other people don't see things this way. And other people might not look at you the same way. And other people don't agree about some very basic things. And that contradiction is how we learn more about the world. You know, years ago, I think you get the point, you know, that the contradiction makes it possible for us to see things we don't want to look at in the world and things in ourselves. So you know, a lot of Zen practice involves confronting people with contradiction. Even though this is supposed to be a path of oneness, you know, koans confront people with challenges to their assumptions about the world, right? So, you know, if you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't comport with what we assume to be the case in reality. And that throws us back into a kind of chaos or disorder. And we have to go through like a process of that's deeper than reason, deeper than thinking. You know, on a very elemental level, we have to go back down into ourselves and sort of like reformulate how we look at the world. It's like one of those pictures where there's something hidden in the picture and you have to find it. And you can't find it until you get have like a cognitive switch and suddenly you find the hidden figure in the picture. Or it's like sometimes if you look at a piece of a Persian carpet, you know, when you just look at a piece of it, it looks totally disordered. And then all of a sudden you look more carefully and you see the pattern emerging from the chaos. Now you're seeing things in a different way. And koans do this too, right? Koans do this too. You know, they force us to undergo a kind of like gestalt switch, you know, that changes the way we emotionally interact and also conceptually interact with the world. So, you know, I myself am somebody who doesn't like conflict. I will do almost anything to avoid conflict. And I'm also a contradiction averse, you know, like other people, I love living in my own little world, you know, but it's definitely the case that I've learned much more about myself and I've learned much more about other people through conflict and contradiction. And so, you know, I think the teaching of Zen is that contradiction is the royal road to awakening. And if you say to somebody, Zen is really about contradiction, they'll really be surprised. You know, if you look at the Enso, however, the Enso isn't usually a closed circle. If you look at it, when it's well done, it doesn't close. There's like a little place where it doesn't come together. It's like there's a little opening into the circle. And if it were closed, then it would be illusion, see? It's the fact that the Enso doesn't close that makes it a real symbol of enlightenment. You know, contradiction is the royal road to awakening because we create a world for ourselves that's centered around ourselves, and we get very good at it. But the world we create is never the real world. The world we create for ourselves is never the real world. It's only a small piece of the real world. And, you know, when we try to preserve the world that we're comfortable in, even though we all do it, I love being comfortable. I love being safe. I love repetition. You know, I drive people crazy. Like, my wife is more of an experimental person. So, you know, if we go to we have a Mexican restaurant in my town where we'll go, Frepes, if you're ever in Plainfield, it's great, great Mexican-American restaurant. And whenever we go to Frepes, I always order the same thing, you know, and my wife will try everything. You know, one time she'll try something that's terrible, one time she'll try something that's wonderful, and I always like this, and it drives her crazy. I'll say, I think I'll have the vegetarian tacos, right, and I'm a vegetarian. So, you know, and they're always delicious. And I enjoy them every time I eat, every one of the hundreds of times I eat them, I enjoy them. But there's something to be said, right, for eating something that might turn out to be a lousy meal, right? So you know more, right? I myself am constitutionally ill-equipped for that. Maybe that's why it took me so long to get into koans. You know, when I started Zen, I really wanted this to be the path of harmony, right, and unity. And it took me a long time to realize that Zen is not about harmony and unity. Buddhism is not about harmony and unity. You know, our community in Seattle started when Takabayashi Genki Roshi, this wonderful, wonderful Zen teacher, came to the United States at the invitation of my second Zen teacher, Kangan Glenn Webb. And, you know, this was the mid-70s, 1976. And when Genki arrived, you know, there were so many, like, young hippie types who were interested in Eastern thought, Eastern culture, who all had Indian bedspreads in their rooms and who were reading the Bhagavad Gita and so on, you know. When this Zen master came, everybody was thrilled. And Genki began to hold meditation at the University of Washington on Wednesday nights, just like we have sitting here at Rutgers. And, you know, maybe 30 people would show up, sometimes even more. And, you know, pretty soon we bought a house in Seattle where we could have a home base. And we began to be a practicing community. And, you know, one of the interesting things, and it was very traumatic for everybody, was that after about 4 or 5 years, tensions began to surface in the group. Personality conflicts began to arise. And actually, those conflicts got so bad that they created a civil war in our community. It's kind of tragic, right? I mean, we had this wonderful community of people, all of whom wanted to be enlightened beings. They all had wonderful intentions. But, you know, contradictions began to surface in the group. So I remember being on a session where I was assigned to dishwashing duty. And I was in the kitchen, and this older woman was in charge of washing the dishes. And basically, I saw this person take a dish, rinse it, and wipe it off. And the woman got very upset. And she said, "There's still soap on that plate." And it turned into this huge conflict, right? It just turned out like it was the middle of a session. And it turned into a big conflict over how to wash dishes. And things like that would happen all the time. And everybody would go back to their corners, right? And sometimes they were more serious personality conflicts. But the interesting thing was that we were unable to deal with the existence of, like, tensions and contradictions in our community because we thought everybody should be perfect and enlightened. But actually, you know, That's not only a false view of reality, it's not Zen. You know, when somebody responds in a way that you don't understand, you know, getting angry because they're disrupting your harmony is actually a very poor strategy for responding, right? It would be, it's a poor strategy because you can't figure out where the person is coming from. If you think any disruption is a violation of your space, of your peace and happiness, then you can't interpret that experience, right? So when somebody does something that's aggressive or disruptive and it affects you, you know, another way of dealing with the situation is to try to understand where they're coming from. And that means saying, how do you think we should wash the dishes? You know, what do you think, not how the hell do you think we should wash the dishes, but how do you think we should wash the dishes? And let the person tell you, and let the person express their concerns. You know, and once you've heard, you know, sometimes the issue has nothing to do with dishes. It has to do with something that's is very different from the dishes. Maybe the person has had, didn't get her colon, her answer to her colon wasn't accepted, and she's upset. Or maybe her son, she's having a bad relationship with her son, you know, and it's coming out during sesshin. You never know. But you know, when you allow the contradiction to be present, and you allow the contradiction to unfold in front of you, and you approach it with, like, not just acceptance, but like real interest, you investigate the contradiction, something wonderful can happen in that process. So when you want harmony and you want agreement all the time, it actually lays the groundwork for these terrible tensions in any relationship. And it definitely tore our community, our Seattle Zen Center community, apart, because we all wanted to be like enlightened beings instead of realizing we're all human beings and we have contradictions that we haven't worked through. So anyway, you know, our community fell apart and, you know, reformed in different ways. But the experience of contradiction is essential. And it's also essential in Zen practice. So, you know, we all start sitting imagining that this is a path of, like, peace and unity. And you sit down on the cushion and you do enter a place of peace and unity. Now, when you get into deep samadhi, deep concentration, unified mind in accord with the way, all seems to be well, right? It's just, you can, after you can enter samadhi and you can deal with your pain, which is also a contradiction, by the way, you know, you're in a kind of tranquil place. You can get very quickly into this beautiful state of samadhi. But if you cling to that state, you aren't going to wake up. In fact, you become kind of a selfish person. You know, people who practice to get a buzz on are not on the path to awakening. So you know, what a good teacher will do is let you enjoy samadhi for a while, but then say, wait, we can't stay here. So here's a koan. And a koan brings right back into your world contradiction. Right back into your beautiful unity, this terrible contradiction. The great Hakuin Zenji called koans these vile, V-I-L-E koans, these filthy koans. But the koan forces you back into someplace you don't want to be, maybe someplace you don't even know where you're going to go. You know, so you're sitting there working with your koan, and suddenly you realize something about yourself. You know, you realize, you know, I have always really been nice to people because I'm trying to get something from them, right? You know, that sometimes we have these recognitions on the cushion. You know, you're working with a koan and you realize I'm always nice to people because I fear them and I'm trying to control them. You know, that's a kind of insight we can have on the cushion that we might not welcome. And by the way, you're a human being, so it's likely you do this, you know. And then you see it, and it's not the image of yourself that you wanted to see, right? We want to be the person who's all wise and just truly generous. And, you know, at some point we're working with our koan, and we suddenly realize, that's kind of who I am. Now, you know, that contradiction allows us to be more fully awake to who and what we are, and it allows us to find. Now, look, it allows us to not just see that, but also understand why we behave that way. You know, I myself made that discovery about myself a long time ago. I was working with Genki Roshi, and he gave me a koan. I won't tell you what the koan is because I want to use it. It's a very good koan. But when he gave me the koan, it made me it made me furious. I was just furious, you know? And I remember sitting in the Zendo thinking that Zen is just a scam. It's just a fraud, you know? Then I realized, you know, this about myself, that I was actually, you know, even people I love, I was manipulating, you know? And then I kept sitting with the koan, and I realized, you know, I'm manipulating people because, you know, fear has been such a big part of my life. You know, in my home, I was often afraid. And then, you know, I spent the earlier part of my childhood in Baltimore, a rather tough neighborhood in Baltimore. And it was like every time I would go to school, I'd wonder, am I going to get beaten up today at school? Right. So I got to be very good at like steering my way through people, you know, to talking my way out of difficult situations, ingratiating myself, sucking up to people so they wouldn't beat me up. Right. You know, and I got very could be funny. I developed a sense of humor. It was like the comedian. Nobody wants to beat up the comedian. So I carried that far into my later life. And if the koan hadn't confronted me with a contradiction, you know, I never would have been able to free myself from this set of habits, right? So, you know, clinging to unity is a big mistake. You know, it's actually a poor strategy for waking up, but we all do it. And we all do it because we want a world that's unified, the unified mind in accord with the way. But paradoxically, or maybe not, you know, the road to the unified mind in accord with the way is through a contradiction. You know, it's the only way we learn how the world really is. You know, but on the other hand, you know, this is the other side of this. The other side of this, you know, the other side of this is preaching facing oneness. We've been talking about not preaching facing oneness, right? So our contradictions, our challenges are the only way we can get into contact with reality. You know, but the other side of this is that when we make a practice out of facing our contradictions, about embracing contradictions, our world keeps getting to be a bigger and bigger world, right? It keeps getting to be a more and more complete world. You know, it's really wonderful. It's really wonderful when, you know, you have a conflict with somebody and you basically confront it. And you work it through, and both people can come away with much deeper insight about themselves. And, you know, as I was saying a little earlier, you know, I think I argued with my mother every day from the time I was about 13 until I went to college. You know, but when I, even now, you know, like many years after, 15 years after she's dead, you know, I remember so many conversations that we had, some of them arguments, but so many conversations. I learned so much from my mother, you know, she was very philosophically minded. She actually was very interested in Zen, right? You know, I think maybe I got my interest in Zen from her. She would go to art museums, and I would go to art museums. I think I got many aspects of my interests in life from my mother. In fact, when I was at the funeral for my mother, when I went to my mother's funeral, people came up to me and they said, "Oh my God, you sound so much like your mother." I was like, "Really? Oh my gosh, amazing!" You know, but I'm, you know, because I thought, really, I argued with her every day for you know 10 years, but of course, you know, it was a deep relationship where we. We learned a lot about each other and about the world, you know. So, you know, usually my experience is that so-called spiritual communities, right, spiritual communities that are successful, that have survived the test of time, you know, develop a kind of maturity about human interactions, you know, and people who are, I think, deeply awake are not afraid of, we're all a little afraid of contradiction. You know, none of us like contradiction. But people who are more fully awake recognize that when contradictions arise, that's our opportunity to live in a bigger world, to face oneness, right? To face oneness. Yesterday, I talked about Senno Rikyu. Senno Rikyu was a lay Zen master in Japan, and he was trying to revive Zen Buddhism. And Zen was in the temples, and it was very sophisticated practice that monks and nuns engaged in. But people outside the temple didn't know much about Zen, and he was worried that people weren't benefiting from the teachings, but also that, you know, popular support for Zen would disappear. So he developed the tea ceremony. And the tea ceremony, I don't know if you know tsado, the way of tea. But if you Google tsado, you can see many incredibly beautiful videos on YouTube of people doing tea ceremony. Some of them are just breathtaking. And it's so simple. All it takes is a bamboo whisk for tea, a bowl, and the bowls would have just been regular rice bowls when this ritual got started, and some green tea, matcha, you know, some green tea. That's powdered. And, you know, you're basically taking hot water, putting it in the bowl, and you're adding, actually you add the green tea first, then you add the hot water, then you whisk it, and then you drink it. And Senno Rikyu made this beautiful tea ceremony, sado, based on Chinese. It was probably a Chinese practice, actually. During the Chinese history, it probably got lost. You know, this probably came from China. But China had a number of, when the Tang Dynasty fell in the Anlushan rebellion, a lot of things in Chinese culture got lost, maybe the tea ceremony. But at any rate, you know, he developed this beautiful, beautiful ceremony that anybody could practice. It didn't require expensive equipment. You could just sit together and do the tea ceremony. So Senno Rikyu was this marvelous person who introduced millions of, you know, really over the centuries, millions of Japanese people to Zen through tea, through the drinking of tea. And yesterday I mentioned that, you know, basically he had a very tense, ongoing relationship with the emperor. And the emperor was kind of a ruthless, you know, you don't get to be emperor by being a nice guy, generally speaking, you know. So the emperor was kind of a ruthless person who was not afraid to chop people's heads off and so on. And Rikyu, you know, was constantly trying to push him to be a better human being. And the emperor was a student of Rikyu's, right? So there's a story about how, you know, at one time the emperor was trying to learn tea ceremony from Senno Rikyu, and he swept the courtyard in front of the Zen house. And everything was perfect. There were no little bits of wood. Everything had been perfectly prepared. And the emperor came to Senno Rikyu and said, "What do you think?" And Senno Rikyu said, "Not quite." And he takes a Japanese maple tree in the fall, right? And when the leaves are red, and he shook it, and the leaves fell onto the surface of the ground, right? It was like, no, that's perfection. And so, you know, Rikyu was constantly trying to teach the emperor the Buddha's way in various ways. But eventually, you know, the emperor did some things that were inexcusable. And so Senno Rikyu criticized the emperor, and the emperor ordered him to commit seppuku. And he did. He committed suicide. You know, this is what it means to live in the world, right? You know, things don't always go the way we plan. And, you know, at the end of his life, you know, Sen Rikyu wrote, you know, this beautiful poem, and I wish I could recall it from memory, but I can't. But it's really about how, you know, this is his greatest opportunity to understand life more fully by encountering death, right? And, you know, again, it's like only through contradiction do we, you know, knowing you're going to die gives life, brings life a kind of brightness and a kind of urgency and beauty that it doesn't normally have. It's the presence of that contradiction that brings it to life. And that's always the case. You know, I don't know if you've noticed this, but, you know, when you're away from the people you love, often they come back to you with this, you know, in memory, with this great power. And again, it's the contradiction that makes them visible. You see them every day and they just see, oh, there they are. But when they're gone, or when they're in the hospital or something like that, you suddenly realize, oh my gosh, what a treasure it was to know that person. So all of us have been working with our contradictions. So even if it's just the simplest contradiction, which is pain in your legs, right? We're sitting on a cushion trying to be in oneness, and the pain in our legs is screaming at us. And we have to figure out how to find that unmoving oneness while we're in pain. But that's the royal road to awakening. And every contradiction after that, even though we hate contradictions, you know, even though we hate them, that's how we wake up. So everybody is doing a wonderful job. The sitting this morning was amazing, just wonderful. And so we have the rest of this precious day to continue to work on our koans and liberate ourselves from our obstacles. So please keep up the good work in facing your contradictions.